Now, when we think about security challenges and defence, we tend to think in terms of military might, fighting wars, strengthening borders against enemy forces, the sorts of things being discussed at this week's Quad meetings in Japan. But increasingly, it is environmental degradation, drought, overfishing, oil spills, extreme weather and the like, which pose a bigger risk, arguably. In our Indo-Pacific region, with its many island states, climate change and related factors have become an existential threat, exhausting the limited resources of developing countries. Is there a role here for Australia and for our defence forces? And what would that role entail? David Brewster's a senior research fellow with the National Security College at the ANU and one of the authors of a study of environmental risks in the Indian Ocean. And he joins me now from Canberra. David, hello and welcome.
Thank you. Good morning, Geraldine.
In a recent piece for the Lowy Interpreter, you wrote that for many Indian Ocean countries, especially the island states, environmental security issues come pretty well at the top of their list of security concerns. Can you be more precise, please? What are you referring to there?
Absolutely. Yeah, look, I did a tour of the island states, Indian Ocean island states, last year, specifically to talk to them about what their security priorities were. And obviously, in Australia, we have concerns about China's growing role in the region and similar issues. And I wanted to hear from them what their concerns are. And it became very clear that if they were to list their top five concerns, issues like China or major power competition just wasn't on that list. Most of their concerns really come in one way or another from environmental change, including climate change. For example, for many of these islands, they face an existential threat from sea level rise. They may just not be there in 10 or 20 years. But climate change can affect a whole lot of other things, including growing incidences of cyclones, population displacement, drought, even destruction of fish stocks on which many of these countries rely. So if we are to talk to these countries, we need to be talking in their language and talking about their concerns.
And you also quoted, for instance, oil spills, which have a huge impact on life and the life and well-being of an island state. And you cited a couple of examples of the risks. In July, for instance, a freighter, the MV Wakasio, sank off Mauritius, spilling 1,000 tonnes of fuel into the sea. What happened there?
Yeah, that's a great example. The Indian Ocean is a major shipping route. It's one of the most busy shipping routes in the world. And so many of these island states are subject to accidents that can occur at sea. And the sinking of that ship was a great example. It sank just off one of Mauritius's pristine maritime reserves, spilling oil and potentially destroying the entire reserve, which also Mauritius relied upon for much of its tourism. And unfortunately, Mauritius didn't have the capabilities to respond. It really didn't know what to do. They were reduced to collecting empty bottles to try and build containment booms.
Oh,
and it
dear.
Was really, luckily, President Macron from France stepped in and said, no, we can assist. And so the French military came in with various experts and equipment and really pretty much saved the day. So that was a great example of an accident which really has occurred in the past. It will occur in the future. And yet we as a region hadn't planned for it. We hadn't sat down and talked about how we can work with each other to respond to these incidents.
I mean, David, your background is in security and defence issues, so it is interesting to see you moving, if you are, into these environmental threats. You're quite persuaded, are you, that they spill over into the security arena?
Absolutely. I mean, yes, you're right. I certainly come from a traditional security background, but I think it's increasingly evident that environmental degradation in one way or another will be a major source of security threats over the next 10 or 20 years, and we need to plan for it. And these security threats can come in all different guises, whether it's droughts causing civil war, as we think happened in Syria, or destruction of fish stocks leading to piracy, or, for example, climate change leading to sea level rise and major population displacement.
The Somali piracy problem is interesting there too, isn't it, which you cite?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, it's a very interesting story. And we all know about how Somali pirates over the last 10 or 20 years have really interfered with international shipping, and that's caused many navies to go to the area to try and protect shipping. The cause of that problem goes back to the 1990s when the Somali state collapsed, and that meant that they couldn't police their own fishing grounds. And so many illegal fishing boats from other countries came in and destroyed all the fish. And that left the local fishermen out of work. They needed money, and many of them turned to piracy. Mm. So it's a great example of an environmental impact leading directly to a major security problem.
And the Syrian one, I mean, the Syrian story is quite remarkable. I think it took a long time for some of us to realise it was really triggered by that terrible drought, which then put lots of people off their land into the cities, which then one thing led to another. So these things often get lost, don't they, the sources of them once the fighting starts?
Absolutely. And if you multiply Syria by, you know, many other countries in coming years who may be experiencing drought or floods or the loss of monsoons, and what that can lead to in terms of civil conflict,
unintended consequences.
Mm. Absolutely, yeah.
So do you see a formal role in all of this for the Australian Defence Force in responding to these threats, what you've called a quad plus? But before we go to that, I'm wondering, does the ADF see itself in this role? Because I know there is some genuine ambivalence about being asked to do things that, say, locals could be hired for, you know. Local quarantine is one of them. It's mixed feelings inside the military.
Yeah, and it's completely understandable because traditionally militaries have had seen themselves as defending the country from invaders and the like, and, you know, that's how they are structured. And so any other missions that they are given mean that they have to use their resources in different ways. My point is that whether or not the Australian Defence Force wants it, they will inevitably be drawn into these issues, and they need to plan for it now. And a great example is the fact that the Australian Navy spent so much of its resources fighting piracy, and also over the last two decades, the Navy has been spending much of its resources interdicting boats, refugees coming from overseas. Now, if there are environmental disasters off our shores, the Australian Defence Force will be asked to help and be on the front lines in responding to those crises, whether they like it or not.
So best to plan rather than just have it
impromptu.
I might add, you're not the only voice, are you, calling for a quad plus?
No, absolutely. And we need to, certainly in the Indian Ocean, we need to be thinking about what Australia could and should be doing with our quad partners, and also France, which is the plus piece of the quad. France is a very active player in the Indian Ocean. They've got one of the largest militaries in the region, and they're very keen to be working with countries like Australia and India, particularly on the environmental security threat.
We've been watching the sort of quad story this week in Tokyo. So it is who's in the quad, and to make it the plus is France, is it? So that'd be India,
yes.
New Zealand, Australia.
Australia, United States, India
and Japan
are the basic quad partners. And there's now the increasing discussion about bringing other partners in for particular issues or in particular areas. And certainly France is a like-minded ally and a very active player in both the Indian Ocean and the Pacific.
I notice you also said is that often expertise, it's not necessarily, we might imagine, a sort of big heavy machinery that can be brought in or whatever, you know, extraordinary helicopters and so on. It's actually the expertise that can be deployed, which is particularly useful.
When we're talking about aid, we're not talking about giving ships or planes or such like. much more effective is our experience in organising these things. And in fact, Australia is really a world leader in the way that we have our civil and military governmental agencies working together. And that sort of experience, that sort of organisation and thinking and expertise, we can bring to the table with our regional partners. And so in many of these countries, we find that agencies, such government agencies, just simply don't work together. They're not used to working together, and we can help and facilitate that sort of thing.
Mind you, we're behind, are we not, what's happening in the Pacific, which a version of this is led by US Defence Forces, who are obviously very comfortable with this new role.
That's right, and it might surprise some, but the US military are very much on the front foot in responding to climate change. Whatever the position of the US government might be, the military are on the front line. They realise that climate change presents a major threat to them and US interests, and they have been working for the last 10 years in organising states in the Pacific to sit down and talk between the military and civil agencies about how to plan for and respond to these environmental disasters.
I should say, shouldn't I, by way of clarification, like this does happen in certain sort of episodic cases. That's ad hoc, I think you say.
Yes.
When I was thinking of the Aceh tsunami, for instance. But you're talking about a really definite command and control structure, are you, a la the military, where people know in advance that that exists, and you think that that will... that has all sorts of geopolitical advantages, and I might add, pragmatic advantages, I would assume, for Australia in terms of making relationships with these countries around us.
Absolutely. I mean, it's not so much command and control, it's about facilitation and cooperation. And so if we're thinking about how to respond to a cyclone, for example, rather than waiting for a cyclone to happen and then saying, gosh, we should send a plane load of aid or food or something, how are we going to do that? Who do we talk to? Instead of doing that, we know that we need to plan for these events before they happen. We know these events are going to happen. We should plan for them. That means we go out to our regional partners. We talk to them. We say, look, when the next cyclone happens, who does what? Who's got what capabilities? You know, who do we call? What sort of aid do you want, et cetera, et cetera? And it's simply transferring that sort of thinking to environmental disasters that we know are going to happen in the future and with increased regularity. And it's a matter of dividing up responsibilities between countries who can help, and also talking with local partners about helping them figure out what they should be doing.
Well, it sounds immensely smart to me. David Brewster, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you very much, Geraldine.
And Dr. David Brewster is at the National Security College at the ANU.